may be the way you used to do it, but that's not the way we do it. And so we had a little conversation about seventh tradition, and he swore that he just didn't understand the tradition. I'm going to take him at his word. And I said, but I'm sorry, I just can't do that. I could, but I'm not. I just will. I'm not working for the federal penitentiary. And I'm not letting the federal penitentiary pay for AA expense. No way. Man, that's as wrong as three left feet. And I said, no, I just won't do it. And he said, well, let's see if we work out something. And I said, well, if as long as it's kosher, I'll be glad to do it. And so he scrambled over there. And then I found, well, I wound up getting, I got a flight. They should have paid me for flying. It was bad. I'm not even sure they had a motor. I think they were flapping the wings. But anyway, we made it for next to nothing. And got through it. And about 2 years later, he called me. And before I could even say hello, he said, now, wait a minute. We've got it right. I mean, this thing is set up absolutely perfect. And even you can't fuss about it. I said, tell me about it. They tell me about it. What they had done, and this is the valuable about keeping your hold on the principle, for God's sakes. What he had done is let the word out that we were going to have to do it strictly by a tradition. And nobody outside of AA going to contribute anything. What happened, the members in the three cities handled the airfare, and I flew on a real airplane. And they handled the airfare. Now here it is. The inmates themselves handled the ground costs. Any cost on the ground. You don't teach people principles by demonstrating what they're not. I probably don't need to tell you the meeting this time was 10 times better than the last one. Because those people were functioning as AA members. They were taken apart. They didn't feel like they had to back up to pick up a cupcake or something. You know, that they were self-supporting. They fit. They helped put it on. What a difference. They don't write checks in there. Good thing, because some of these were bad checks. But this is the withdrawal sheet. Some of us know what a withdrawal sheet looks like. This one is a withdrawal sheet. And the guys wrote down, and all they do is do this, and then they'll move the money from their fund to another fund. And it's absolutely perfect record keeping. There is no discrepancy in that, none. And so these are the guys who signed up and paid those expenses. And that's what principles are. That's what traditions are about. I went to a prison. I went to a prison in North Carolina a while back, and the guys there, I mean, I only made it was about a 200-mile round trip, 250-mile round trip, something like that. The guys in the prison sent me a check for mileage reimbursement. Well, I mean, I said, man, this is crazy. I'm not going to take money from these guys for that. I mean, that was total service. And I had an intelligent thought for once. I thought, my God, what an insult to tell these guys they couldn't play in the game. What an insult. I don't. A few weeks later, I got a voucher or something, I think, from the a 100 stories that go out of them because they're all vitally important. But the eighth one is about you can't buy it or sell it. You know, that AA should remain forever non-professional. We're talking about a little thing about a local center here in Portland or wherever we are. And anytime you put money with it, it's no longer AA. You know, it's an outside function. You know, it's an outside function. And so you can't sell AA service nor buy it. It's kind of like that guy on that 12-step call. Money would blow that right out of the sky. You know, you got to have it so this heart-to-heart kind of stuff. And so I could tell you a bunch of stories about that and where folks who got a little money could just absolutely wreck it if you let them. But very important principles. Ninth one is about, we kid around about it, that we ought never be organized, and we rarely are, but we do remarkably well. I like the wording of that tradition because it makes a message, kind of like the second one. AA as such, you know, carrying the message to the other alcoholic, that AA as such. The most noble and the biggest that AA ever gets is one alcoholic talking to another. That is the heart and soul of everything we do. And the rest of it is just numbers and extrapolation. But that's exactly what the heart of it is. And for the AA as such ought never be organized. That we cannot define how that'll be done. You know, that's something that's got to be God-given. It's a spiritual thing. And we've got to go in there geared to trying to carry out God's will, carry this message to the person who still suffers. And so we ought not to ever be organized. You know, my group is a well-structured group. And I went over that thing yesterday, that if there's a service in AA, it exists in our group actively. I don't mean we put posters up about it. I mean we actively carry it out. And so that's organization. We can create service committees directly responsible to those they serve. And so in our service committees, every one of them are autonomous parts of our group. They function totally within the group. Don't have to go to the business meeting for anything unless they need some extra money for something. Otherwise, they operate totally within the people who function in that group. Works great. Works absolutely great. So certainly, and that gets stuff done. You know, so not organizing doesn't mean chaos rules. You know, you got to have ways that people can sensibly understand what you're doing, so they got a chance of getting in on it. And 11, the last two or 10, you, a lot of ways to say it that we have no opinion on outside issues, and our name ought not to be drawn into public controversy. All that means that I've got to be real careful about how freely I speak. I have to be careful because I'm a very active guy in the program, and I'm not unknown in my state. And so I have to be a little thoughtful when I want to make some kind of a public statement. It even gets close to something that's next door to AA, because by insinuation, you know, I can draw other people in. And I'll just slip in one quick example. We had a tragic thing happen, as sometimes happens. A couple of young people came into program and boy meets girl thing, and they got tangled up in something, and very tragically they were together one night and whatever happened, the guy brutally murdered the girl, and I don't guess any such thing as a non-brutal murder, but I mean he smashed her head in with a rock, and I mean just brutal crime, and so naturally it was all over the paper. But you know, and it bothered everybody, bothered me particularly, because it made it sound like AA fosters this kind of activity, and this is what you have to look at happen on the campus. The way you read it, it would almost have to be read that way. Well, I'm trying to figure, what on earth can you do with this? You know, the paper has a dilemma. There's the public's right to know. A newspaper does not have the freedom to withhold information. They have to report public information. And they can't hold back just because it's us. And so I'm trying to figure out, what on earth can I, just one guy, what can I do? About a week later, another writer, he was not contradicting anything in that article, but he did a follow-up article with an unusual amount of sensitivity about how he dealt with it. Facts are still there. But the sensitivity with which he dealt with it, I thought was extraordinary. So I wrote a letter to the editor of the paper. I wrote a letter to him, the writer, and commended him for the excellent article, you know, and articulated why I appreciated it so much. And it said, at bottom line said, feel free to use this letter any way you wish. And that meant publicly, or go show it to your boss and tell them you're doing a good job, whatever you want to do. But anyway, you know, it's just a way, you know, he couldn't withdraw what was done, but maybe we could help to be a little more sensitive next time. Maybe. But at least it's a step, eh? And so that thing is, but it's tricky, you know, when you start dealing with publicly like that. Got to be awfully careful that I don't insinuate you when I start making some kind of a noise somewhere. And so it is. I also like to put gossip under that heading. That's within this fellowship. I think it's awfully important that we have a bond of trust in Alcoholics Anonymous, that what comes on, what goes on here stays here. That can be a life-saving value to have in a program. I've seen tragic stuff happen. I have never seen anything positive come out of gossip. It is a killer kind of a thing. And so I look at that in the 10th tradition as just mind your own business, you know, for God's sake. So don't be getting loose with somebody else's, because this is not a bingo party. This is a place where critically ill folk are trying to hang on to a new life. And man, we don't need to get cute with that kind of stuff. And so very important. And those last two about anonymity are vitally important. I'll just use this one little story to talk about that. That, you know, anonymity. It's that same meeting that Bill was in. He was talking about anonymity being poorly understood with some people, thinking it was about hiding and all that. I'll just give you one little example to think about on this, and maybe add it to the homework you got yesterday about watching where drunks hit the wall and stand there mystified. Let me add one other little thing. In fact, Kent was. We did a workshop with a bunch of guys down in the Bay Area, and Rick was there. So anyway, there was a bunch of us there. Bad cases, and there were I think maybe four or five guys came in from L.A. or from Hollywood, and four young guys, and they were not gangbangers or anything. They were just some young guys out trying to have some fun. And I think they heard there's a bunch of old dudes meeting up on the mountain up there somewhere. So we'll go up there and we'll harass them a little. And so they came in and they were just bopping around, you know, and jiving. And I kind of watched them a little bit. They kept making a little run. Everywhere they'd run, they'd get a stone wall. You know, we had nobody playing the game with them. Finally, they settled down. And we had a good time. And one of the guys, if you recall, one of the guys brought up, he said, one of the problems we deal with, particularly in Hollywood, is this thing of musical chairs with celebrities in and out of treatment. And my God, that's no news anywhere. You go to Tupelo, Mississippi, they'll know it just as well as we do here. And so it's a tragic thing that's going on. Not only tragic for the patients involved in that, it almost dooms them to failure with all of that spotlight, notoriety, and it's a big problem. And I tell you the two last things on that. One, what's happening is not just the travesty and the tragedy of what's happening to people caught up in that. It's what's happening to the fellowship in the area of anonymity. Like, what's happening as this stuff, it sells papers or something, so it's always on the news. And what's happening is we, Alcoholics Anonymous, is becoming the punchline of jokes on late night television. We're the punchline. We're the butt of the joke. And that's a bad place to be. When we start becoming a laughing stock because we're part of that kind of a tragic revolving door, that's a bad deal. And so I said to the guys from Hollywood, just out of the blue, and I'd ask you the same thing. How long do you suppose it has been since anybody has gone to the editor of your paper and just had a talk with them about the criticality of anonymity for people in early recovery? I know what their answer is going to be. pretty well bet on it. Nobody can recall when that's been done. You know, we've gotten awfully lax in this whole business of CPC, of how we cooperate with the professional community. Editors and writers get no training in understanding anonymity. If we want something done, we have to do it. And but it'd be a simple matter, you know, for somebody to just pick up on that and just go make a visit. Somebody probably knows. I did a little, not a little. They every once in a while, my paper will run a full page deal on some old dude that's dying on the vine, I guess, or something. They got me one day, and they started interviewing me big time. And Ryder was a good guy, and we got all through with it finally. And it was on my professional career. And when we got through, he said, you know, you have an interesting pattern in your educational development. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, I've never seen anybody that would start so many schools and then change so often. What happened? I said, you ever heard of time off for bad behavior? He said, oh, yeah, yes, I have. And he said, you know, I heard a little something about you. Are you in AA? And I said, you better believe I'm in AA, man. How you think I got that spotty record? That was getting qualified for AA. So, and he said, God, let's keep writing about it. No, can't mix the metaphor. You know, that'll be a different thing. Yeah, but we had a good talk about just the kind of stuff we're talking about. And anonymity is not just a matter of my... In AA, every one of us ought to be entitled to as much privacy, anonymity, as we think we need. Because we're not all in the same boat. Yeah, sometimes we overuse that word we, that we're like. No, we're not. We are a bunch of very different individuals. And where I'm wide open, many people can't. You know, I got a brain surgeon that's been working on me a little bit. And I don't know whether he's in AA or not. I haven't asked him. But if he do, I guarantee you, I'm going to be talking to him about how long you've been sober, boy. Yeah, I want to make sure. If he's still shaking, I'm going to let him practice on somebody else. And so, sensitive for some people. And so I think we always have to be conscious that certainly I'm free to be as I'm open. I'm open. And I don't violate my anonymity public level. Because I don't have the right to do that, you know, and that has other implications. But otherwise, like in AA, I always use my full name. This is my family. I don't want to be anonymous with my family. If you come to North Carolina, I want you to know that my name is Tom Ivester, and that I live in Southern Pine, North Carolina, and I've got a listed phone number, and I bought that sucker so people can call me. And so call me. That's the way I want to function. I don't want to come into AA and sit here with blinders on you. Don't let anybody see me. That's not me. You know, so I want to be wide open. The downside to that is right here. The world of technology has caught up with us. And the genie's out of the bottle. You know, right now, anybody that does recording and is hooked up, you know, to the World Wide Web could take a talk just like this tonight and tomorrow. It could be in sale in Cairo, Egypt. The genie's out of the bottle. You know, I don't know how we're going to deal with it. I really don't. Because here it is. And I just simply don't want to compromise how I function in AA. But at the same time, I don't want my name publicly displayed at Kmart selling CDs. Somebody called me about that, and they said I was on eBay. Had CDs on eBay. And somebody called me and asked me, are you selling it CDs? I said, are you crazy? And no. And looked at that. I wouldn't have minded, but the price wasn't good at all. I mean, so anyway, it's a whole bunch to consider and that stuff. So let's, Chris, you tell us what to do, and then we'll do it.
Let's take about a 7-minute break.
month of our anniversary. They sort of underline the scope of the problem and which group conscience is going to do anything about it. And so it really is. It's a worldwide kind of a deal. And very frankly, we're losing the battle in terms of maintaining singleness of purpose. It's unfortunate, but very true. Yeah. Right here. Yeah. Yeah, just I tell you my personal perspective is that I think we have to be patient with people like that. And bear in mind that most people coming out of treatment of any sort, whether it's a residential facility, long-term housing, or whatever, most people come out of a facility where there's an institutional-type program, and they're developed so that is the common language. And so that's what you're going to hear. If you get a treatment group, you're rarely going to hear somebody say, I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's always going to be a bunch of stuff. Part of it is that, some of it anyway, is that third-party payment is becoming more and more of a challenge, less and less available. And we're already at a point where you almost have to have multi-diagnosis to qualify for a reimbursement. So, you know, we're building ourselves into a trap with this thing. And so that's why I say I think we have to be patient. And when people come in, the way I like to look at it, a person coming out of treatment is in day one of recovery. They know absolutely nothing. I just assume they know absolutely nothing about the principles of AA, about things like this stuff, about criticality of anonymity, about you know, how you identify yourself, that kind of thing. I don't think, I just take it for granted they know nothing about that. They've been patients in a hospital dealing with their resistance to getting well. They don't learn recovery in there. You know, they learn how to get ready to engage in recovery. And so that's why I like to treat them in that fashion, that they're brand new, and we'll encourage them to go through the newcomer program. That's where you learn the functions of being a member. And being patient, what you typically find is that people just, they're habituated to that terminology. And, you know, if it lingers too long, some of us will privately talk with somebody. Yeah, and what I try to do is just get them to understand that the more you broaden a thing, the weaker it gets. The more specific, the stronger it gets. And so I try to get people to understand that if I told somebody here this weekend that the thing I would recommend is to go to a lot of meetings and to examine yourself, because all of us, I think, pretty well know fundamentally that we're either basically an addict who drinks or an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic who sniffed a lot of speed. But I'm not a drug addict. You know, I was a drunk with a big appetite and very few scruples. But I think fundamentally we'll get to that. But I don't like to rush people and give them a chance to sort of decompress from what they've just gone through and to realize that that's really not necessary. You always do it and just say, I'm not like you guys, you know. And that's what it communicates. But I like to be patient with them personally and let them work their way out of that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Amy, that's alcoholic.
I am. Yeah, that's a great question too. I think anonymity is another name for humility, and that to me is what it's about. It's in the whole essence of the 12th tradition, about the practice of anonymity. It's the key to it. The most sensible thing I've ever heard. The real key to it is to do something for somebody and not let them know it, and that's the essence of anonymity. Is to give the gift with no credit, and when I can do that, I'm getting anonymous. I'm getting humble, and that's what it's about. It's to protect against big eye and all this kind of stuff, and certainly give personal protection. But I think that whole spirit of anonymity is to do with credit, so that I don't take credit for what's happened, that I don't let people crow over, what a wonderful person I am, and all that stuff. No. I want to stay well grounded on that. And I think that's exactly what anonymity is about. It just put the word humility in there, and you got it covered pretty well, I think. But I think that's the spirit of it. It's not about secrecy and hiding and stuff like that. It's about the big I, the big me. There's some people, and I've had them tell me, that they didn't want to be anonymous because they thought it would be helpful to their friends if they knew that they were in the program. I tell you what thing happened. I got a phone call. I got a letter. I was involved in a conference, and you got a little tax procedure that you have to go through with the IRS if you're going to, I don't know exactly what we get out of it, but you have to go through the IRS to get your tax stuff going with the conference stuff. So I'd made contact with them, and I got a letter, and it was addressed to Tom Ivester, Alcoholics Anonymous, in my street address. And so I called. I don't particularly care, being the postman. I mean, my God, I'm not uptight about that. But I am uptight about the looseness with anonymity. And so I called IRS and got a lady on the phone and told her, I said, all I want to do is just get a little correction in my address. And she said, oh, what's that? And so I told her, I said, how this address? I said, I'd like you to take that Alcoholics Anonymous about it. And she said, why? I said, well, you know what that anonymous means? And she said, yeah. I said, well, we try to be anonymous. And I was trying to be light with her. I said, we really don't broadcast to the world. And she said, just about like what I just quoted, she said, well, did you ever think about how encouraging it might be to other people to know that you're in AA? I said, yeah. But I've also thought about how many I might run away with letting them know I'm in AA. And so, I think it's that kind of thing that you can get carried away and take this big deal, and I got to let the world know about it. But that whole spirit of anonymity is to do something for somebody and not let them find out. And then we're right on track. We're right on track. I think, anyway. Yeah, thanks, Amy. Anybody else? All right, we'll push you to bed early now. Yeah.
Thanks, Chris Alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Tom, do you think there are some groups, maybe because of their notoriety or size, that may affect other groups or AA as a whole, and that they have an added responsibility to by singleness of purpose and this division?
Yeah, I think it goes under that fourth tradition about autonomy. These groups free to be itself, provided that it doesn't put a hurting on the group next door. And I think in the spirit of autonomy, part of the evaluation needs to be what kind of a neighbor are we? You know, not you know, about the pushing and shoving, but what kind of a neighbor are we? How helpful are we to other groups in our setting? And, to give you an example, we're putting on we're calling it a sponsorship rally. And so what we're doing is inviting all other groups to participate in it. In the spirit of being a good citizen in our community, for our group to be a good citizen in the community. And so I think as long as we're doing stuff like that, so that we're reaching out and we're participating in intergroup and stuff like that, I don't think we have a heck of a lot to worry about. It's like I mentioned yesterday about, and it's a fact, we literally have to planfully block vote to keep from dominating the district. Because we don't want to dominate the district. You know, we just want to be one of the players. But we don't want to see our district be a dead duck, you know. And so, you know, it's a sort of an approach avoidance deal, you know, that it's just like we're the biggest, baddest group around out in our little area. And we're the only real strong, well-ordered, purposeful kind of a group. And there's some nice meetings around, but they're just in a different category than our group. And so we have to be careful that we don't insinuate some sort of excellence that goes with that. We got a lot of people who don't like our group because they don't like structure. They like that freewheeling kind of get in there and talk about how much you could drink last Thursday and all that stuff. And so anyway, I understand the question, and it is so easy to let that whip out of shape, and you get, I imagine Pacific Group, Sharon, you guys probably run into that. That's a huge group. First time I ever spoke out there, a long time ago, I agreed to the group and gave proper, you know, kudos to the size of the masses, and then I said, but I sure hope you folks got somewhere to go to AA. And there was this sort of shocked look that rippled through the crowd, and everybody's going to see who's going to hit him first, you know. But I'm kidding around a little bit about it. But there's some reality to that. When you're the biggest kid on the block or several blocks, that's a pretty challenging kind of a thing to maintain. Yeah, I think there's just a little extra responsibility that goes with that. You know, to be a good neighbor, to be supportive of the stuff in the community, and you know, if we can do that, I think we're okay. But there is that danger, and when you're the most active guy most active group around, that has just some fallout from it. You know, but just have to live with it. Yeah. Anybody else? Anything? Comments or questions?
Just to retort, we have about 20 other meetings that are smaller during the week.
Yeah, I know you do. I know. I've been to some of them. Yeah, Chris. Yeah.
What would you say, in your opinion or your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the single most divisive thing that you've seen in a group? The thing that creates a lack of unity?
It's really kind of hard to pin that down. You could always say a general thing like personalities. That's usually far more than substance. It'll be just warring individuals. It's a big, 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 biggie. I really don't know. I think money is one. People often get into fights over money. You rarely get... let me reverse it. I have never seen a fight over the primary purpose. What you fight over is the minutiae, you know, of who's in charge of this or who forgot that, you know. It's the minutiae that eats away at, nibbles away at a group. But when you get around the primary purpose, there's never a fight about that. You know, that's where we unite. And I was in a business meeting one night, and I just made, before we broke up, a kind of a random comment and asked a question and not expecting an answer. You know why we have good business meetings? And, of course, nobody said anything. And I said, I believe it's because we talk about what we're doing. We don't talk about a whole bunch of stuff or who put the chairs here and all this kind of stuff. And we'll take care of all the housekeeping if we have to. But the primary thrust of our business meetings is the business of the primary purpose. We want to hear from the treatment committee about what's happening at detox, rehabs, you know, the places we do work. We want to know what's happening in corrections, you know, so that we can not just know about it, but be supportive of it. And so, you know, that's the spirit we try to get. And that is why we have good business meetings, because we're talking about the primary purpose. We tolerate the reports about the money, but that's no big deal. You know, the big deal is what we're doing, and that really pulls us together. So, I don't know, it's just money and personalities. I think an awful lot of just failure to perform. You know, a lot of groups, they don't just die, they get killed by people who take jobs and not do them. And man, that is murder, when you get people who take commitments and not show up. And it's a hell of a deal, you know, that, you know, our goal on that says that our commitments will be kept. And if you can't make it, we'll get somebody else. But we always want that covered, because there's no such thing as an empty commitment. What you're sending is a message, we don't care. That's the message. And I guarantee you that's what people hear. They don't hear somebody's car broke down, you know, or they didn't have any gas. That's not what they hear. They hear nobody. In California, they got a term. I'm pointing at Kent, and he moved. There's a saying in H&I in California, when somebody doesn't show at a correctional place, they call it a dark night. It's a great term, because I think it is totally descriptive, you know, of what that means. But I think stuff like that will eat your integrity to pieces. And bad news. Yeah.
Someone that's obviously as passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous and the traditions and maintaining that, at what point or how have you figured out where to choose your battles? At what point do you get involved in? At what point do you think that it's, you know, it's worth working for, or it's just not your deal?
Within a group or just generally?
Yeah, or within your area or within your group would be a given, I would think, but... Yeah. You know, my deal is going to other meetings and not, yeah, you know, wishing it was being done different, or mm-hmm, you know, how we do it, or what. Mm-hmm. And at what point do you just say it's mm-hmm, not your deal?
Yeah, I don't mess with other people's groups. I don't offer, you know, unsolicited advice is the most useless thing known to man, and so I just don't give any. Yeah, you know, if folks ask, you know, if they want to do a workshop, if they want to talk about it, I'll do that. But I don't offer unsolicited advice. That, you know, people build groups to fit them. And that doesn't mean I'm going to like it. But it does. If people do that, then it fits their peculiarities. And so I don't have a right to ride herd on some other group, you know, and go in and start imposing. Membership is ill-defined. It's ill-defined. We don't have stringent things about membership. You know, hey, it's the easiest thing in the world to join. You're a member when you say you are. Nobody, there's no committee to screen that. If you say you're a member, you are. And you're a member, do you either quit or take a drink, whichever comes first. And so it's easy to quit, too. But I know I was sitting in a meeting one night down in my area. It was not my home group. And I was sitting there, and they did, you know how they do the nose count periodically? We are tremendously difficult people to count. For good reason. And I sit there in that group, and they had that thing, and get a nose count of how many here, and they said, everybody that considers this a home group, stick their hand up. Well, I had people from my home group stuck their hand up. I'm the only guy in the room didn't stick his hand up. And the guy beside me punched me and he said, why don't you stick your hand up? You come over here sometime. This is not my group. Yeah, my God, man, I'm a visitor. But now how do you count that? Well, we say we've got 2 million millions. Good guess. Good guess. Maybe 9. Who knows? But I mean, it's whole business. Remember, I told somebody at a workshop down there a while back, I honestly believe if we just rang a big bell in our little old communities, rang a big bell and said, everybody report to your home group, that half of our meeting places would be empty. Because what we've got is sort of a nomad culture. You know, and folks just sort of wander around, you know, hither and yon. And they don't really have a membership. Don't have a sense of membership. And so we are very difficult to deal with. It's a live and let live kind of a thing. You know, and God knows there are tons and tons of meetings that I just dread walking into if I happen to do it. I'll tell you one other little thing about the criticality of that kind of thing, of why it matters, just aside from just the integrity of calling something Alcoholics Anonymous. The very human side of that. I was in a meeting, not an AA deal, but there were some AA people, and it was one of those community meetings, you know, where folks were going over a bunch of you know, social concerns and what have you. I think I was representing corrections then. And I was on a panel, and the panel right behind me was a group of people from a mental health clinic. And the last speaker was a psychiatrist. And I swear to God, he was the most tired-looking, defeated man I think I've ever seen. You know, and they introduced him, and he just kind of lunged across, you know, like he was just dying on his feet. And you can tell he wasn't overly thrilled. And so he got up to speak, and he said a few things, and he said, my biggest problem is alcoholics who have a second diagnosis. It was my biggest problem. He said, I know logically that AA is the place to send them. But it seems that when I send them there, they come back worse than they were. And he said, I need help. Now, the man was sincere. He wanted help. Well, I wanted somebody to answer from that community. And I knew some sitting in the group. But some folks had just refused to speak up. And, the man needed answers. So I said, well, darn it, I'll do it. So I stepped up. And I said, I know you're serious about what you're talking about and that you genuinely want help. I said, let me just tell you that I'm an AA member. And I understand what you're talking about. I said, one thing you got to realize, for starters, everything that flies the flag is not the same thing. We got a lot of things that fly the flag that don't even come close to being an AA meeting. And I said, I understand about somebody coming in and coming out worse. I said, I know meetings that if I go to, I come out worse. So... my God, man, you take some of these things where you get into that what you call it, guy, Jerry Springer look, you know, with a bunch of razzmatazz. You got me saying it, razzmatazz. But you take somebody that's borderline, what do you think everybody's talking about you? Paranoid. Yeah, you got borderline paranoid or you're just coming out of severe mental illness. My God, you put him in an environment like that, of course he's going to be worse. And so I understood it was a very legitimate concern. And I said, the only thing I can recommend is that you get to know 2 people, just pick a number, 2 people, that you trust. And then when you've got somebody that you're uneasy about making a referral, you call them. Tell them what you got, and they will tell you about where they need to go. That was the best I could do. You know, I wish I could say if there's a sign on the door you go in, it'll be a good place. But that's wishful thinking. Wishful thinking. And so, you know, I want to be careful that with somebody like that you don't send somebody in there and make them worse. You got to be thoughtful about that. And but it's the kind of thing you run into. You know, when you're trying to get hold of AA as a resource, it's got a lot more to it than just how I feel when I walk in. That's no big deal. Yeah. But when somebody tries to use us, you know, I wish I could say that you could pull in someplace and call the 800 number, you'd be safe. Don't bet on it. Don't bet on it. You know, it's high risk. It is high risk. Right now, if somebody asks me for a contact, if they're going traveling somewhere and they say, you know, can you get hold of somebody in Boston? You know, I make it my business, if I'm going to try to help them find a contact, to identify a person. You know, I want them to call a human being that is, I know is going to take care of business. And, you know, I wish it weren't that way. But by golly, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's just kind of luck of the draw. I had to go to Memphis, Tennessee to do something, and I took a guy sponsor with me. And we went over, and we wanted to catch a meeting. Now, Memphis, Tennessee is a big city. And so we went into Memphis, and now I've been finding AA groups for a long time. I'm not a rookie at it. And so we got into that town. I started looking for a meeting and having no luck. Because when you look in the Yellow Pages, people that are marketing something to do with alcoholism or addiction, they figure the more A's they got, the better listed they get. So you'll start out with 9 A's, and then it'll sort of winnow its way down. Well, trying to figure out what's AA in there, take somebody smarter than me. You know, I called up one number, and I got a guy in Miami, Florida. And I said, well, I don't want to send anybody down there. It's me. And he said, what's the biggest town there? I said, I'm in it. I mean, my God, this is the biggest town. Well, you imagine that. Called a club that was listed. And some poor girl was severely, severely mentally handicapped. And she answered the phone, hello. And I said, hello. And she, I could see what it was. I said, look, we're just looking for a good open meeting somewhere. It's open speaker meeting somewhere. She said, I don't know about that. I said, well, is there anybody there that does? And she said, here, speak to her. And she gave the phone to somebody worse than her. You know, and so I said, is there anybody else there? She said, they all in a meeting. So that was how far I got with that. And we gave up, finally. We gave up in a huge city in the United States. The next day, Al Noz might be pleased to know this. The next day, I said, I'm going to get a hold of somebody before I leave this town. I called Al Noz. And a woman answered the phone. I said, God, I'm glad to be talking to you. And as I told her the deal, and she said, you have got to be kidding. I said, no, I'm not kidding. Man, we called 25 times last night. And again, she said, I'll tell you what, you sit where you are 3 minutes and somebody will be calling you. And they did. And so I got hold of it. Well, now, it was a thing that will happen sometimes, but they just hadn't patched it up. They had some phone problems. And rather than getting some kind of rerouting for a call or something like that, it was just left dead. And so when I got with the guys later on that day, I said, you know, no, we're not upset about that thing. I mean, I'm okay, and the guy with me is okay. But suppose we had been somebody in a hotel getting ready to jump out the window. He said, well, I think I'll try one more thing. See, that's what we got to think about. It's not somebody that just gets aggravated. My God, man, this is life and death stuff. And so I guarantee you that, man, we got to 2 meetings almost immediately with those folks. They felt horrible about it and should have, you know, that. But anyway, it's just an adventure. You know, when you start trying to find AA in a place, get some of these answered services, and I swear to God, I cannot understand what to say. So anyway, it's a huge challenge that I think we're faced with. Yeah.
Last one, Tom.
Traditions in the workplace?
Correct.
Well, traditions are simply a set of principles, just like, and I think literally just like they are. Just like they are. If I practice these things as they are and then just make them personal, you know, instead of looking at group, like the first one, it's our common welfare comes first. All I do is change the wording. In fact, that's the way I read the book most of the time. My welfare comes first. You know, it's the same thing all the way down. For my group purpose, for my purpose, there's but one ultimate authority. And so on. I personalize the traditions so that I don't try to make that language fit my personal deal. And that just really makes it come alive. And I don't fly the AA flag in my business, but I use these traditions. I tell you one thing that literally happened is I stopped a government reorganization one time with the fourth tradition. Now, I didn't tell anybody what I was quoting, but we were getting ready to make a stupid decision, and I was at a high enough policy level that I was one of the decision makers. And what we were going to do was cannibalize one agency and put it with another, and it didn't fit. And I knew it didn't fit. And so in the course of the debate, they were talking, and I was thinking. And finally, I said, are you folks familiar with the principle of autonomy? And they looked at each other and said, well, yeah, I know what it means. What are you talking about? I said, well, it simply means that two entities don't have to eat each other to have a good working relationship. And you don't have to destroy one entity, you know, to make it have a better purpose. And so just that simple challenge, you know, and we're going to spend a couple of $1 million to do something totally counterproductive. And that simple word of autonomy. So, you know, that's how I use it in the workplace. And, so it's just a matter of taking the deal there and making it fit what I need to get done. Great tool. Now, I could have written a long, long report on that, but I couldn't have been any more effective. Just use that one word, and it just stopped that reorganization. And it never has occurred since I left. Yeah. Yet they remember the word, I think. Yeah. Yeah. But I find it real easy to use. Yeah. I forgot. Right here, and then we'll hang up.
Follow-up to your singleness of purpose question. You know, also with people having alcohol and drug issues, you got people that are definitely alcoholics, but also have issues with other addictions, be it gambling, be it sex, be it any number of different things. And I think they, too, are also, as you term, flying as a different color of the flag. How do we deal with those type of people in a loving way and make them feel included so that they are not also leaving more wounded than they come in also?
Yeah. Well, you know, I find it very easy to deal with. The book lays it out well, is that we have to have enough wisdom to know when we're in over our heads. And we have to be willing to make a referral to an appropriate place. And I think that's the wisest thing we can do. You know, sometimes if people have got just some nuisance behaviors that are going on, the steps will affect every area of our lives. But if somebody is continuing to bog down, I don't hesitate to not only refer them to another deal and go to that in addition to AA, you know, if they need to, or to a professional. I don't hesitate to send people to a professional. And I think it's highly appropriate. I think we have to realize that we're dealing with a very critical human condition. And the suicide rate in AA is high. It is high. Usually in early recovery is when it happens. And so I don't ever like to minimize the importance when somebody brings up a troubling thing that's going on with them, because you never know how troubling. And so I want to be sure I hear that. And then if it's beyond the scope, if it looks to me like it's beyond the scope of what that person's able to do in AA, you know, I will lovingly encourage them to seek additional help, help them find it. But that's what I do. I don't think we can broaden our agenda to accommodate it in AA. You know, that we do. Well, just, everything's got an example. You know that we had a guy in our group that had Tourette's syndrome, and I wasn't even sure what it was, but he taught me, because the fellow would sit right here, nice man, but that's an uncontrollable thing, and all at once he would just let out a yowl like a hyena or something. Well, the speaker found that a little disconcerting when he would do it, and so somebody forget to tell him. And I took a little look at what Tourette's was, and I watched the guy. And this guy was in agony trying not to do that. So we looked at it. In our business meeting, just talked about it and said, we need to handle that with some sensitivity, because the man's absolutely helpless to deal with it. And so they very kindly elected me and the guy that went on the 12-step call me, which was that rich guy that died sober. Yeah, so we got to deal. It's amazing. Now, I don't think God just really did this, but it happened. We set up the meeting. He and I were going to do it because the other guy was more gentle than me. And so we were going to just help him. All we were going to do was maneuver him to a different seat. Yeah, we weren't going to throw him out. We were going to say, "I'll sit back there, and then you can yell to your heart's content. It'll be okay. You're not going to bother anybody." And he moved the next week. And we had nothing to do with it. Yeah, but he moved the next week. But I think that's just typical of the kind of thing you got to do is be sensitive to the fact that we get damaged goods in here. And if we don't watch it, we can let people really get into serious trouble with some notion that we're going to fix that. You know, and some of it's way beyond our control, way beyond our capacity. So I just think you got to be sensitive. Also have to be sensitive about issuing proclamations about medication. That's gotten to be a fairly popular trend in some parts of the country where folks are just flat declaring to somebody, "You have got to stop that." I tell you one thing, as a correctional administrator, the one thing that no sensible correctional administrator would ever do, even though you've got all the authority in the world, you never overrule medical advice. Never. If you do, you're paid for it. And so I think that's the kind of standard that you got to think about when you start doing that. Because, man, it can be extremely dangerous. Yeah. So, you know, those are troubling kind of things. Yeah. I'm glad you're thinking about them. And I am too. Yeah. Well, folks, you guys have been great.